Well, we'll be considering Mark chapter 2, verses 13 to 22 this evening, so you might want to turn there in your Bibles now. Now, I want to remind us just at the beginning here that we read this passage in the context of a particular event which has taken place earlier in the book of Mark. And I'm referring there to the arrest of John the Baptist. You remember there how back in chapter 1 we saw what looked like the fruitful ministry of John the Baptist, the Messiah's forerunner. And yet what happened? Well, he clashed with the authorities and he was arrested. And so then, as we read the early chapters of the book of Mark, we find ourselves wondering if John has been taken away by the authorities, the forerunner of the Messiah, what is to happen to the Messiah himself? And last time we considered the first part of this chapter, we saw that Jesus has already provoked silent objections from the authorities. You remember how he forgave the sins of that lame man, and by doing that he caused a stir among the Pharisees. Now the Pharisees kept their words to themselves, but inside they burned with anger. Who could forgive sins but God alone? This Jesus of Nazareth is committing blasphemy, they thought. But they kept it to themselves. Now, however, as we continue to read throughout chapter 2, we'll find that those silent objections begin to be verbalized. They become spoken objections, first in the form of seemingly innocent questions, and then eventually out-and-out accusations. And this evening, then, we'll consider the first two of these objections. The first in verses 13 to 17, and the second in verses 18 to 22. Now, we could consider these objections as separate incidents, I suppose, but I have chosen to consider them together this evening for a couple of reasons. Firstly, because if you read Luke's Gospel in chapter 5 of Luke, Luke certainly gives the impression that these two incidents weren't separate, but they happened on the same occasion. And secondly, just most obviously, it's clear that these two incidents are united by a general theme. These two objections have things in common, and that is they concern the dinner table. They concern eating. It's in this area of dining and eating that Jesus receives two complaints. One complaint concerns who Jesus dines with, and the second complaint concerns the manner in which they dine. And I call them complaints, but I guess on the surface they do just appear like questions. And I'm not saying that everyone who's asking these questions in these passages was making allegations. But the context of these questions certainly suggests that what at this stage just looks like innocent questions will soon be a reason for outright rejection of Jesus and his ministry. And so for now, I'm happy to call them veiled complaints. So we'll consider these two complaints then under two headings. And the first is this: a complaint about company. A complaint about company. Our passage begins in familiar territory. Verse 13 takes us back to the shores of Galilee. And here, once again, we witness the same kind of drama that we saw back in chapter 1 and verses 16 to 20. Back then, it was the fishermen, Simon and Andrew and James and John, who were yanked out of their day jobs, leaving their nets and their families and their businesses behind at the drop of a hat. And we dwelt then upon the spectacle of those four men instantly dropping everything at the call of Jesus. And we emphasized then the authority of Jesus' voice as he calls them. But we also shouldn't neglect another astonishing feature of their call to discipleship. And that is, when you grasp that the authority of King Jesus, surely what's really astonishing is not the fact that these fishermen should immediately submit to his call, but the fact that Jesus should call fishermen in the first place. I mean, Jesus is this great divine Messiah, this great king. He's coming in to establish a kingdom. That's the context Mark has placed us in. He's coming to rescue this lost wilderness world held captive under the forces of evil. So who does he rally as his first recruits to join his army? Well, he rallies fishermen who just happen to be in the right place at the right time, just going about their day job. But now look at our passage. And again, in verse 14, we have this call. Follow me, he says to Levi. And again, we have this astonishing immediacy, don't we? Levi just leaves his tax booth and follows Christ immediately. But we also see something even more extraordinary than that. You see, Simon and Andrew and James and John, yes, as rough working class people, they were hardly the most obvious recruits to be generals over the army of Jesus. But what about this man, Levi? Well, here, Levi is also a very unlikely candidate for the job. His day job is not the kind you'd think would appeal to a mighty Messiah king. But here, it's not that his job is strange because of its ordinariness or its roughness or its simplicity. It's not that Levi is the kind of man who smells like fish and has hands covered in scars from the fishing nets and has a laddish sense of humour or something like that. That's not what makes him an unlikely candidate. No, you see, it's not that Levi is a nobody, like a fisherman or a shepherd. Rather, Levi is a somebody. He's just the very wrong kind of somebody. Levi was an unlikely candidate because Levi was a tax collector. That is, he was a man who was employed under the very unpopular government of Herod Antipas, which itself was, of course, subordinate to the pagan Roman Empire. He was a man who was in the business of squeezing out whatever he could from the pockets of his fellow citizens, handing it over to these dislikable authorities, and then profiting off whatever else he could swindle out of his friends. You see, Levi was a traitor. And as a member of the establishment, he was seen as a traitor to the common man and to the nation. And as a man who did business with Gentiles, he was also deeply impure in the eyes of the religious authorities. He would have been expelled from the synagogue, completely despised. And so then, Levi is a deeply unpopular man with everyone. His job carries a serious social stigma, and yet, and this is perhaps the most galling thing about him, Levi is the kind of man who's prepared to go into that kind of job, knowing full well what people would think of him because of it, and yet he does it anyway. And he doesn't do it because he has some deep-seated love for the Roman Empire. He doesn't do it because he's committed to some higher principles. No, the very opposite. Levi is doing this, at least as far as his friends perceive, because of the money. He was a social outcast because of his own free choice, isolated from high and low, good and bad alike, not by accident, but by a commitment to his own greed, getting money out of his fellow men. You see, there are social outcasts in this world who we can easily look upon with pity, can't we? The homeless, or the drug addict, or the alcoholic. But then there are also these outcasts who even the most charitable of us are inclined to think should remain outcasts. And Levi was one of those people. That's what made Levi such an unlikely candidate to join Jesus' company. And yet, despite all of this, Levi is called, seized from the tax booth, the latest recruit to Jesus' followers. But that's not all. Surprises keep on coming. Notice how we have this shift in scene in verse 14. See, in the space of two verses, we go from this social outcast sitting in his tax booth to verse 14, him reclining at table with many others around him in verse 15. And reclining, by the way, is not just another term for sitting. No, reclining does actually have that sense of luxury about it that perhaps we have something of in the English there. No, in the Greek, that's the case as well. Think about Roman or Greek banquets with guests spread out across the couches. Now, whether they were literally reclining in that manner in this passage is not really important, but it's significant that Mark chooses to create that kind of atmosphere in using that word. And as Levi then looks up and down the table, who does he see? Well, he sees something very strange. He sees a room filled with tax collectors. And not just tax collectors, but sinners of all shapes and sizes, all the despised folk of society, all the gamblers and the fraudsters and the perverts. And they're all reclining here, so Mark seems to indicate, like cultured Roman aristocrats around this table, eating and chatting away with Jesus of Nazareth and his scruffy disciples. It's an absurd image that Mark is painting, and as we move on, we'll see that it's bursting with deeper significance. But for now, it shouldn't surprise us then that someone puts in a complaint. Someone objects to this situation. See, for Jesus to eat with these people, these tax collectors, these sinners, he's putting more than just his ritual purity at stake. You remember when Jesus touched the leper in chapter 1? Well, there, that was an issue of ritual purity. But here, the concern is more of moral concern. It's not simply that this is a table of lowly people like fishermen, or unclean people like those with leprosy, or ill people like the paralytic earlier on. No, surely for all their haughtiness, the Pharisees could at least see something commendable in helping these people. No, this was a table of bad people. This was a table of sinful people. And Jesus, friend of sinners then, was causing a moral problem. And possibly even we don't grasp just how scandalous it was for Jesus to be a friend of tax collectors and sinners, as he's described in Matthew chapter 11. We can forget, can't we, that behind all of the profound sermons and the touching interactions that we read about in the Gospels, Jesus is for many a friend. He's more than just a friend, of course, but he's not less than just a friend. And these sinners then, as they're sitting around Jesus at this table, they're not just a mere audience around him. They're a community around him. Yes, they're listening closely, they're attentive to his every word, but they're also enjoying the casual Jesus, Jesus their friend. The same Jesus who commands the lame to walk also asks his tax collector friend to pass the bread down the table with a smile and a nod. And so this is a scene then of friendship and leisure, and for that very reason it is scandalous. People wonder, does not bad company corrupt good morals, Jesus? Or perhaps it's your corrupted morals that have attracted this bad company after all. Questions must be asked. And the question is asked in verse 16. Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners? Ask the Pharisees. And Jesus answers. And whoever you are this evening, and whatever your circumstances might be, please let Jesus' answer to their question sink down deeply into your ears. In one sense, I hardly need to explain or apply his answer to the question. It speaks so clearly for itself. Verse 17. Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners. Now, I would put it to you that if this comment means nothing to you this evening, then if it's neither a comfort to you nor a rebuke to you, then I would suggest that you've really failed to engage with it at all. You see, for some people, this response is a very sharp rebuke, isn't it? Is there not a twinkle in Jesus' eye as he directs this answer to those Pharisees? Don't worry, he says, I didn't come for perfect, righteous people like you. Oh no, perfect, righteous people like you have no real need for me. So you just keep to your own business, thank you very much. It's quite an infuriating, sort of sarcastic little comment, isn't it? You see that the point is clear. Jesus is saying, I'm not here to spend time with all those clever, moral, perfect people who think they've got it all sorted. I'm not here to join some religious echo chamber where I can talk down about all those lesser people out there. No, that would be like qualifying as a doctor, only so that I could start attending medical conferences, all the while that thinking that sick people were just a bit of a nuisance. The point is, this is a table of sick people who know they are sick and who have found their physician. But there's a worse sickness than the sickness of these sinners and tax collectors. There's a sickness which leads people to think that actually they're not sick at all, but actually well. That's how deep that sickness goes. There's a sickness, there's a sin which blinds people to their own real need, and perhaps even fools them into believing that they're the most righteous people of all. And that's the sickness of the Pharisees. As to the law, blameless, they say, with the unconverted soul. And it's these people then who have the true sickness that have so much trouble with Jesus, friend of sinners. Let me put it plainly for you this evening. If you think you're doing all right with Jesus right now, if you think you're well and moral and upstanding and you don't need anything else, you don't need Jesus, then let me only say this. Fair enough. Jesus has not come for you. That's what he says. If you think you're righteous already, then listen closely to his words. I came not to call the righteous. And if you look on this gathering here in this passage of broken sinners around this table, sitting around with Jesus, all these tax collectors and sinners enjoying his company, and you look at that and you're appalled and you're confused and you want nothing to do with any of that, then listen again to Jesus' words. I came not to call the righteous. And if you look at the church then, and all you see in the church is a group of poor, weak, foolish people with dodgy backgrounds all fawning over this Jesus fella, and you think, I'm above all of that, then once again listen. I came not to call the righteous. I remember one day when I was at university with a good friend of mine, a Christian friend, and we were talking about our faith to another student, a history student who was on my course. And this Christian friend of mine, he's not the most attractive of people. He's quite unhealthy looking. He's rather peculiar in appearance and personality. But one thing you can say about him is that he is a changed man. And he took the approach this time of sharing his testimony with this student friend. And he explained to this student, this history student, how as a teenager he used to burn with anger and hatred against his school bullies who picked on him for his peculiarities. And he would fantasize about seeking revenge. He even decided to study physics at university so that he could one day possess the scientific know-how to get revenge in the most dramatic and disturbing of ways. And then one day this friend read Pilgrim's Progress. And as he got to that scene where Christian reaches the foot of the cross and his burden falls off his back, my friend was instantly converted. And in his own words, God took all of the hatred out of his heart and replaced it only with love. And as I listened then to my friend telling his testimony to this other student, I thought, surely this story would impress this student. Surely he would be unable to be convinced by the love of Jesus as he heard this beautiful story. But what was the result? Well, the result was that this student was appalled by my friend. He said my friend was psychologically disturbed, messed up. He wanted nothing to do with such an unpleasant person, and he certainly had no need for his religion or his saviour. And if that's your attitude this evening, then again I say to you, I came not to call the righteous, says Jesus. But if, on the other hand, you have the tiniest doubt that you might not be the righteous this evening, then please carry on listening. Because while the self-righteous bars himself from the table and refuses to eat with Jesus, it's the self-conscious sinner who up until now had considered himself outside of the bounds of forgiveness, who now finds themselves spending an intimate time and a close space with and eating and conversing at the same table as Jesus, the Saviour, the friend of sinners. And surely you'll agree with me that anyone in their right mind would want to be right there in this man's presence. And if that's you then, if you know anything of your sickness and sin, then do not hesitate to come to Jesus. Whether you're coming for the first time, or whether your life is a constant process of coming, then just come again, be drawn to this table. If Jesus has room for Levi, this most unpopular man in the world, this tax collector, this man who up until then had been so obsessed with his own greed, he was prepared to betray everything else to get it. If Jesus has room for him, then you are most welcome. Perhaps you feel your sin, you think that is a great obstacle. Well, look, it's not an obstacle. It is your very invitation. It is the very thing which should draw you to the physician. There is room at Jesus' table. Others might complain about this company. That's nothing to Jesus. He invites the very worst, if only they will come to their physician. So that then is a complaint about company in verses 13 to 17. But secondly, this evening, I want us to consider our second objection, and that is a complaint about consumption. A complaint about consumption. And that is verses 18 to 22. And of course, this complaint also concerns food. But now it's a complaint which is not so much against the eaters themselves as against the eating itself. And the question being asked is in verse 18, why do John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast? The question is why Jesus' disciples don't observe the same kinds of ritual fasting which was observed by John's disciples and the Pharisees' disciples. And again, we don't know exactly who is asking this question this time. Perhaps some people were asking it out of complete innocence. However, the other Gospels again shed a bit of light on this. Matthew chapter 11, we find Jesus referring to this same line of inquiry, but in this case, he characterizes it not as an innocent question, but as vicious slander, and he connects it to the first complaint. So listen to Matthew chapter 11, verse 18. Jesus says, "For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say, he has a demon. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, look at him, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners." You see how he ties together those two complaints, that complaint against the company and that complaint against the consumption. And so then I think it's safe to assume that here, behind these innocent questions, and I'm not saying that everyone asking them was asking them in a slanderous kind of way, but I think we are seeing the beginnings, at least, of a sort of slanderous allegation. Serious complaints about Jesus' consumption of food and drink. They're seeing these disciples eating and drinking, and that's causing them serious problems. It's arousing in them strong emotions. They think that is unpleasant and wrong, and they have to voice those concerns. And for the remainder of this time, then, I just want us to consider how Jesus responds to these complaints. And once again, we should see that Jesus doesn't merely answer the question. He answers it in a way which casts light on his identity. Yes, he answers it, in fact, in verse 19, by first asking a question. He asks, "Can the wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them?" And then he gives them their answer. "As long as they have their bridegroom with them, they cannot fast. The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in that day." See, he doesn't dismiss fasting in and of itself. He says that a time is coming when fasting will resume, in fact. But for now, he compares himself to this bridegroom who cannot help but be a cause of celebration, and that celebration implies and involves eating and drinking. "How could anyone fast while I'm here?" he's asking. "With me, every meal is a banquet. With me here, there is joy for everyone." You know, this is one of the reasons why it just can't be possible to read the Gospels as if Jesus is a merely good man. Good men don't make these kind of claims about themselves, insisting on the joyfulness of everyone else who spends time with them. That's the sort of talk of a tyrant or a deluded narcissist. But no, that's not Jesus. Jesus is this source of real joy and merriment and happiness. That's what he's insisting upon here. And of course, I don't just mean to say that Jesus is just claiming to be some really fun, dynamic, infectious sense of levity sort of thing. That's not what he's saying. That would be far too trivial. But at the same time, we mustn't fall into the trap of thinking that the joy Jesus brings in this passage is merely some kind of deep, profound thing, almost totally divorced from real emotional experience. I mean, yes, for most of us in this world, Christian joy can and must coexist in a profoundly deep way with hardship and difficulty and trial. We must have joy in the face of trial. But here, in this passage, I want to go further. I want to say that the joy Jesus brings to his dinner guests in his physical presence, to a great extent, does not coexist with those hardships, because by its very nature, it obliterates all sense of mourning and struggle. All of the sadness was overwhelmed in the midst of Jesus the bridegroom. Sadness was not allowed to survive. Now was a time of joy and celebration. And the evidence of that was this consumption, this food and drink, eating without reservation. Sadness was not allowed to survive. And yes, sadness and fasting would soon return once the bridegroom had departed, but for the time being, it had no place. You see, fasting is all about removing one's attentions from immediate pleasures, sacrificing those things, and then for a season devoting oneself to gazing upwards with undivided attention towards the invisible God in prayer. It's about self-restraint, it's about discipline, it's about steadying oneself and postponing those natural human impulses. And in the midst of this chaotic and worrisome world, that is a good practice to be part of. And at times, that behaviour will feel very fitting, very appropriate. In the face of crises, tucking into a good meal feels like the most unnatural thing to do. To eat would be to express a kind of relaxation, which just wouldn't be appropriate. Prayer must come first, and that may often involve fasting as well. And as appropriate as all that is, the point here is that in the immediate presence of Jesus, that desire to fast becomes a thing of the past. Jesus' physical presence brings relaxation and reclining, is the word we used earlier. And that sense of liberty, which just allows the hand to stray across the table and pick up another piece of fruit from the fruit bowl, or another slice of bread, or another piece of flapjack, or whatever it might be. See, when the invisible God makes himself visible in the presence of the bridegroom, fasting and prayer are replaced with feasting and conversation. And fasting, then, in his presence, is not merely inappropriate. It should raise questions about whether you are really taking the joy of the bridegroom seriously enough. You see, there's sort of a cloaked concern in this question about fasting, isn't there? The concern is that Jesus and his disciples are not taking religion seriously enough. They're not taking the spiritual life seriously enough. By not adhering to these fasting rituals, they are promoting a kind of hedonistic attitude, undermining a seriousness of religion. And perhaps you have sympathy for that kind of attitude. Perhaps you look at this passage and see the eating and the drinking and you think that's just not what should be appropriate for serious religious-minded people. But Jesus turns this on his head, doesn't he? His point is exactly the opposite. His point is, were my disciples to fast in my presence, were they to fast in the presence of the bridegroom, that would be deeply inappropriate. That would not be taking their bridegroom seriously enough. And that's why then he uses these striking analogies in verses 21 and 22 about garments and wineskins. Verse 21, no one sews a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. If he does, the patch tears away from it, the new from the old, and a worse tear is made. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the wine will burst the skins, and the wine is destroyed, and so are the skins. But the new wine is for fresh wineskins. The point is that old wineskins are not stable vessels for new wine, and you can't just put a new piece of cloth on old garment without it tearing away and there becoming a rip. Bringing these two things together is inappropriate and disruptive. In the same way, then, you can't lay down old carpets in the middle of a flashy new hotel, or you can't employ mourners to come to your wedding without that sort of disparity just being so inappropriate that it causes a minor disaster. And equally, then, this kind of ritualistic fasting It might have been totally appropriate when people were watching and waiting and praying eagerly for their coming Messiah, but it was by no means appropriate once their Messiah had arrived. Jesus could not be contained in that old restrictive skin. If you try to do that, you would only spoil everything. So you see, celebration is a serious business. And if you try to make it even more serious by making things more severe, then you actually end up undermining the serious goodness of the moment. You end up profaning what is meant to be enjoyed. Don't kid yourself into believing that the more austere you are, the more serious you are about religion. Serious religion is about joy as much as it is about austerity. So where does all this leave us? Well, we're in a peculiar situation today, aren't we? Because on the one hand, our bridegroom has been taken away, as we read in verse 20. By the way, taken away, that's a strangely violent expression in this passage, which is about a wedding banquet. It's so strange that liberal scholars doubt its authenticity. They don't think it was there in the original. But Jesus is being deliberately jarring in using that language. As we said already, he knows he's on a path to clash with the authorities. He knows he has a violent end, and that end was Calvary. And for us then, he has been taken away. But at the same time, we have a bridegroom who has risen again, who has ascended, and who has given us his Spirit. And we have the Comforter of God then living inside of us. So what are we in today? Are we in a day of fasting, or are we in a day of feasting? Well, let me put it like this. As we look back at these passages in Mark chapter 2, we do see something that we have no longer. We do not have the bodily presence of Jesus Christ. Yes, we have a relationship with him right now, a personal relationship, but let's not kid ourselves. We don't commune with him in precisely the same way as these sinners and tax collectors did. And if we pretend that we do, we've not fully grasped what it means for him to have departed. So in a sense then, we are back in that day of gazing upwards to the invisible God, praying and fasting for his personal return. Nevertheless, we are not back to square one. Because as Christians this evening, we have the privilege of looking at this passage, seeing those sinners reclining in their seats, reading of this bridegroom and all this feasting and this new wine, and saying then, he has come once already, and he's coming again. And when he comes, he will prepare the greatest banquet the world has ever seen, and the food's already cooking. And are we not then, this evening, those who have, in the very least way at least, tasted a drop of that new wine? We have had a little bit of a nibble of our first starter. Indeed, just in taking communion, in eating the bread and the wine on that occasion, we are reminding ourselves of that great heavenly banquet which is to come. Or when we gather together here as a fellowship, we are reminding ourselves, anticipating that greater fellowship around that banquet table that is to come. But it's not here yet. It's a bit like when you're invited to Mike and Pat's house and you're sitting in the living room nibbling on those crisps and sipping your mango juice and your stomach's rumbling even more right now, having tasted that little bit of the banquet which is to come, that's being prepared out of the way. And little do you know at that point that there's another 5 courses to go and you're going to go home that night feeling very satisfied indeed. And when our bridegroom comes then, there will be a feast of great quality and quantity that we can scarcely even imagine now. There'll be a table around all the nations, around which all the nations will sit. And if you're a follower of Christ this evening, there's a seat with your name on it. So allow this passage then to send you home tonight with a sense of fresh hope, with a rumbling stomach. For you, today might feel like a day of fasting. You might feel the mourning and sadness, you might feel the departure of Christ very keenly. And the idea of him returning then might seem like a great distance away. Well, look at this passage and let me remind you that it really isn't that far away. It's closer than you think. The food's already being prepared. The oven is on and the table is almost set. And on that day then, all of your anxieties, all of your worries, your pains, your sadnesses, your illness, Your mourning, your fasting, all of that will be snuffed out and replaced by the most satisfying and joyful resolution. And so I encourage you then, wait for the bridegroom, look to Jesus, and look forward to that wonderful banquet. Amen.